Imagine a metal so critical to our future, so fundamental to everything from electric cars to the very power grids lighting our cities. Yet its supply is, well, incredibly concentrated. It could almost dictate the pace of global innovation.
That's right.
We're talking about copper. And today, we're diving deep into a company holding, really, a disproportionate share of its destiny. Southern Copper Corporation, ticker SECO.
It's a fascinating one.
Okay, let's unpack this then. You've given us a really rich set of sources for this deep dive. We're looking at a detailed investment analysis report, comprehensive company SEC filings, and various market updates from across 2024 and even into 2025.
A good spread of information.
Exactly. And our mission today is, well, to cut through the noise, bypass the jargon if we can, and really extract the most important actionable nuggets of knowledge about SECO. We want you, the listener, to walk away truly understanding its remarkable strengths, its unique challenges, and why it's such a pivotal player in this whole drama of global electrification.
And what's truly remarkable here, I think, is that in a world that's increasingly resource constrained, SECO holds, you could almost say, the master key to a multi-decade supply of the world's most critical energy transition metal, copper.
A master key, huh?
But, with that immense power comes a surprising vulnerability. We're not just looking at a mining company here. We're exploring a titan, an absolute titan with an unparalleled asset base, a cost efficiency that's, frankly, almost unheard of in the industry,
right,
and a crucial role in shaping our energy future. So you're going to get a comprehensive picture today from its global footprint and impressive financial health to its ambitious plans for future growth and the very real geopolitical tightrope it continuously navigates.
Sounds good. Let's get into it. Let's start then with the big picture. Southern Copper Corporation as a premier copper powerhouse.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the analysis we've received paints a very clear, almost, well, ideal picture of SCC, one of the world's leading integrated copper producers.
That's the headline, yes.
And when you look at its core identity, it's really defined by this unique combination of world-class assets, industry-leading cost efficiency, and a clearly defined long-term organic growth trajectory. That sounds like the perfect setup. But what's the one critical crack, maybe, in this dream team armor that even the most bullish analysts are quietly watching?
You're getting right to the heart of it, yeah. While all those strengths are absolutely true, the primary tension, and what we'll definitely dig into, is the extreme geographic concentration of those world-class assets.
Oh, cool.
But let's not get ahead of ourselves just yet. To put a finer point on their strength, SECO holds the largest copper reserves globally, period. Think about what that means for a moment. It provides just unparalleled long-term production visibility.
Decades, potentially.
Exactly. In an era where the world is, frankly, desperately seeking materials for the energy transition, everything from EVs to massive renewable energy grids, SECO is not just positioned well, it's practically guaranteed to be a primary beneficiary. They simply have the copper in the ground to meet that surging demand for decades to come, far beyond what many rivals can even dream of. This isn't just a strong position, it's foundational. Foundational to their multi-generational potential.
And their financial profile really seems to back that up. The report highlights exceptional financial strength and this first quartile position on the global cost curve. Now, this isn't just some fancy term, right? It means they can produce copper cheaper than, what, 75% of their competitors worldwide.
That's exactly right. Top 25% globally in terms of low cost.
Imagine running a marathon and you're always in that top group for endurance. That's the kind of competitive edge we're talking about, especially when prices get tough.
Yep.
What's even more impressive is how they achieve this. The report mentions it's partly through significant byproduct credits. So how does all this ensure robust profitability and substantial cash flow generation, even during periods of depressed copper prices? It sounds almost too good to be true in such a cyclical industry.
It's not too good to be true. It's really a testament to their deep-seated operational advantages. This financial resilience allows them to do two critical things simultaneously. First, they can fund their truly ambitious growth pipeline.
The 50% increase one?
That's the one. Aiming for a staggering 50% or more production increase by 2032. And second, and crucially, they can maintain a generous dividend policy, all without compromising their investment grade balance sheet.
Which is key.
It's a crucial differentiator. It sets them apart. Many of their peers are out there chasing risky, often, frankly, value-destructive M&A deals just to secure future supply. SECO, by contrast, is essentially self-sufficient. They're growing from their own proven high-quality assets. So you're looking at a company that can invest heavily in its future and handsomely reward shareholders, all while staying financially robust and, well, conservative. That's a rare combination in the capital-intensive mining sector.
Fine, and there's always a but, isn't there? The analysis also quickly flags some initial risk flags. It says these considerable strengths are counterbalanced by a significant and concentrated risk profile. So where exactly do these risks lie, and just how concentrated are we talking?
That's where the geographic footprint comes right back into sharp focus. It really becomes their single biggest Achilles heel. Their operational footprint is almost entirely concentrated in just two countries, Peru and Mexico.
Just two.
It's just two. This exposes them to a high degree of geopolitical and regulatory uncertainty. These regions, they have a history of social unrest and political instability, which can directly impact their operations and, importantly, their project development pipeline. We've seen concrete examples of this in the past where local opposition or shifts in government policy have significantly impacted production or delayed crucial new projects. It's not theoretical.
Right. It's happened.
And as a pure-play copper producer, their financial results are highly sensitive to the inherent volatility of copper prices. That's just the nature of the beast. Plus, the capital allocation framework, which we noted is heavily skewed towards dividends, is largely influenced by Grupo México, their majority shareholder.
The parent company.
Exactly. And while this provides a reliable income stream, which is good for income investors, you have to ask yourself, does this priority limit their flexibility? Does it limit other value creation strategies, like, say, opportunistic share repurchases? Which, interestingly, have actually been dormant since 2016.
Dormant since 2016, despite right. having the capacity.
Correct. It's a clear strategic choice, but one that seems largely dictated by their majority owners' cash requirements, perhaps more than optimal capital allocation for all shareholders.
That clarifies the concentration of risk quite a bit.
Yeah.
So let's dig a bit deeper into these operations then and their geographic footprint. The analysis notes SECO is a major vertically integrated producer, meaning they handle everything from mining to smelting and refining. And as you mentioned, their focus is geographically concentrated in Peru and Mexico. How does this vertical integration work across these two key regions? Does it give them a significant edge?
Oh, absolutely. It's central to their almost unrivaled cost efficiency. Hmm. In Peru, their operations are conducted through their SPCC Peru branch.
Wow.
This includes two world-class open pit mines, Toquepala and Cuajone, both located high up in the Andes Mountains. Massive operations.
Hmm.
And what's critical here is that these mines are supported by a dedicated smelting and refining complex down in Ilo on the coast. Think of it like a farm that not only grows its own amazing produce, but also owns the processing plant and the distribution network right alongside it.
Total control.
Total control. This complete command over the entire chain gives SECO incredible oversight on quality, it minimizes external reliance, and crucially, it allows them to squeeze out every single ounce of cost efficiency from their operations. From the rock in the ground to the finished copper cathode, they don't have to rely on third-party smelters or refiners, you see, which can add significant costs and introduce logistical bottlenecks.
Makes sense. And their Mexican setup, does it mirror that Peruvian integration perfectly, or are there different operational nuances there, maybe giving them a different kind of edge or perhaps a different challenge?
Mm. Their Mexican operations, managed through Minera Mexico, are equally extensive and integrated, but with a slight twist that actually enhances their overall resilience, I'd argue. The cornerstone is the Buena Vista mine, which is incredibly significant because it sits on one of the world's largest copper ore deposits. It's a true geological marvel.
One of the largest.
Yes. And this complex includes two concentrators and two solvent extraction electrowinning plants, or SXEW plants as they're known. This multifaceted design allows them to process different types of ore deposits, old tailings, new ore, and extract copper using different methods. It adds to their operational flexibility quite a bit.
Okay.
Beyond Buena Vista, they also operate the La Caridad complex, which is another major open pit mine. And uniquely, their Industrial Minera Mexico, or IMESA unit, operates five underground mines.
Underground. Interesting.
Yes. And what's fascinating here is how this IMESA unit produces a more diversified mix of metals. It's not just copper. It includes zinc, lead, silver, and gold as well. Now, this diversification isn't just about adding extra revenue streams, though it does that. It's actually a key contributor to their incredibly low-cost structure.
The byproducts again.
Exactly. The revenue from these byproducts directly offsets their copper production costs. It's a concept we definitely need to explore in more detail.
Okay. So beyond just where they mine and how they process, the sheer scale of what they hold in the ground is, well, astonishing. This report continually hammers home SCCO's unmatched reserves and byproduct riches, and for good reason, it seems. Can you give us a sense of just how massive these reserves are? Why are they considered their most significant competitive advantage?
It truly is immense, and it's arguably their ultimate differentiator. SCCO is widely recognized, no debate here, for having the largest copper reserves in the world. As of the end of 2022, the company reported an astonishing 71.9 million metric tons of contained copper in reserves.
71.9 million tons.
Million metric tons.
Yeah.
To put that in perspective, that's enough copper to build, I don't know, millions upon millions of electric vehicles or power hundreds of thousands of wind turbines.
It's hard to even grasp.
It is. This isn't just a lot of copper. It's effectively their golden ticket for decades and decades to come. And it's complemented by substantial additional resources that could eventually be converted into reserves down the line. This vast endowment is precisely what underpins the company's long-term production profile and allows for its extensive pipeline of organic growth projects. It provides a mine life that far, far exceeds most, if not all, of their major competitors.
Right.
It gives them incredible long-term visibility and a strategic advantage that is incredibly difficult, maybe impossible, for new entrants or even established rivals to replicate. You just can't magic up reserves like that.
That's an incredible amount of copper. But you also mentioned byproduct riches. While copper is obviously their primary focus, just how significant are these other metals, molybdenum, silver, zinc, to their overall revenue and, importantly, their cost structure? You hinted at a cost deflation mechanism.
They're absolutely crucial. It's a brilliant, almost elegant aspect of their business model. While copper accounted for, let's see, approximately 76.6% of their total sales in 2024.
It's still the vast majority.
Oh, absolutely. Copper is king. But these valuable byproducts significantly boost their financial performance and fundamentally alter their cost equation. Molybdenum is the most significant after copper, contributing about 10.9% of 2024 revenue. Then you have silver at 5.1% and zinc at 3.8%.
Yeah.
And here's the crucial part. That cost deflation mechanism at play. The revenue generated from these byproducts provides a substantial credit against the cost of copper production. Think of it this way. While copper is the star of the show, imagine it's a multi-talented performer. These other metals, like moly and silver, are like valuable bonus tracks on an album.
I like that analogy.
Yeah. The revenue from these bonus tracks doesn't just add to the top line, it directly reduces the cost of producing their main hit, copper. So, hypothetically, if it cost them $2.10 to dig out and process a pound of copper before considering these other metals, well, those valuable byproducts can effectively bring that net cash cost down by a substantial $1.30 per pound based on 2024 numbers.
Over a dollar per pound reduction.
Yes. It makes their copper incredibly cheap to produce compared to rivals who don't have these significant extra revenue streams coming in. To give you some concrete production numbers from 2024, SCCO produced about 2.1 billion pounds of copper, 64 million pounds of molybdenum, nearly 290 million pounds of zinc, and 21 million ounces of silver.
Huge numbers across the board.
Huge numbers. Plus, the recent commissioning of their Buena Vista zinc concentrator is expected to significantly increase zinc production, maybe by as much as 32% in 2025. That will only further enhance those byproduct credits and solidify their cost leadership position.
That clarifies the mechanics of their cost efficiency perfectly.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about something that's often overlooked but critically important. The Grupo Mexico connection. SCCO is an indirect majority-owned subsidiary of Grupo Mexico SAB de CV. What exactly does that ownership structure look like? And, well, why does it matter to us as we try to understand SCCO? Does it impose any limitations on SCCO's strategic choices?
It matters a great deal. As of year-end 2023, Grupo Mexico, through its wholly owned subsidiary Americas Mining Corporation, or AMC, owned a dominant 88.9% of SCCO's capital stock, almost 90%.
Okay, so very much in control.
Absolutely. This controlling ownership has profound implications for SCCO's corporate governance, its strategic direction, and even its day-to-day agility. Now, on the one hand, it provides a stable, long-term oriented majority shareholder, which can be a positive. But it also means that key decisions, especially those regarding capital allocation and strategic priorities, are heavily influenced, you could say, dictated by the objectives and cash requirements of the parent company. This relationship is most evident, crystal clear, really, in SCCO's dividend policy. It has consistently favored very high payout ratios, effectively upstreaming cash to Grupo Mexico.
sending cash back to the parent.
Exactly. Now, while this ensures a reliable income stream for all shareholders, including the minority holders, you have to consider the trade-offs. This clear preference for dividends over other potential value creation strategies, like those share buybacks we mentioned, being dormant since 2016 despite a strong balance sheet, well, it's likely driven by Grupo México's own financial structure and cash needs.
Yeah.
It also means that SCCO, while flush with cash and operating from a position of immense strength, might prioritize its parent company's immediate cash needs over, say, building out a more diversified portfolio to mitigate that geographic risk we talked about.
Or maybe making an opportunistic acquisition.
Or even pursuing opportunistic acquisitions that could benefit minority shareholders significantly in the long run. It's a strategic choice, no doubt, but one that appears largely dictated by their majority owner. This limits SCCO management's direct control over certain aspects of capital deployment and perhaps strategic agility in a rapidly changing market.
So we've established SCCO's dominant position, their unique cost structure, and the significant influence of their parent company. Okay, let's zoom out now and look at the broader landscape, the global copper market itself, and how SCCO fits into it. We're about to explore a market undergoing, it seems, a profound transformation, and discover how SCCO is uniquely positioned to ride, or maybe even define, the next great wave of demand. Here's where it gets really interesting, according to the analysis. The copper market is cyclical, we know that, but it's currently undergoing a significant structural shift. What is this shift, and why is copper so absolutely central to it?
Look, the energy transition, it's fundamentally a copper story, period. And it's the most powerful thematic tailwind for SCCO and indeed the entire copper industry for decades to come. A copper story.
Copper is simply indispensable for it. Think about it. Everything from the electric car in your driveway, which uses maybe triple the copper of a traditional combustion engine car.
Triple? Wow.
Roughly, yes. To the solar panels on your roof, the massive new wind turbines that contain literally tons of copper per megawatt, the battery storage solutions needed to stabilize the grid, and the fundamental expansion and modernization of our electrical grids themselves, they all scream copper. These are not just incremental changes. They represent a fundamental rewiring of our global economy. And this rewiring makes the economy significantly more copper-intensive than the fossil fuel-based infrastructure it's replacing.
Much more copper needed per unit of energy, essentially.
Right. Precisely. This structural shift is projected to drive annual copper demand from around 25 million tons today to over 36 million tons by 2031.
That's a huge jump in less than a decade. It is, and that creates a substantial, persistent, and frankly undeniable supply deficit projected for the future. If we connect this to the bigger picture, you're looking at a multi-decade tsunami of demand, which positions companies like SCCO with their vast reserves incredibly well for the foreseeable future.
So the long-term picture looks incredibly strong, driven by these undeniable global trends like electrification and renewables. But what about the short-term market dynamics? Copper prices can be notoriously volatile day-to-day, month-to-month, right?
Oh, absolutely. In the near term, the market remains highly sensitive to global macroeconomic conditions. China, for example, consumes over half of the world's refined copper.
More than half.
Yes. So its economic health has an absolutely outsized impact on prices. We've seen recent volatility exacerbated by things like potential U.S. import tariffs, which can create dislocations in global trade flows and definitely impact sentiment. And you get these conflicting signals that can be a real head-scratcher for market watchers. The International Copper Study Group, the ICSG, they noted a small market surplus in early 2025, which might suggest, okay, maybe there's a bit too much supply right now.
Right.
However, many other analysts, and I tend to lean this way, believe the market is already in a structural deficit due to ongoing supply disruptions, think mine issues, political problems, and resilient demand that isn't perhaps fully reflected in those official statistics yet. This raises an important question for you, the listener.
Huh.
How do you interpret these conflicting signals? Are we just seeing short-term noise and inventory adjustments before the true structural deficit really bites? Or is it indicative of a deeper, more immediate challenge for copper demand? It requires a really nuanced understanding of both the macro and the micro indicators.
That's a great point. It's not always straightforward. And on the supply side, the report talks about supply constraints and even a potential looming shortage. Why is it so incredibly difficult to bring new copper production online, even with demand seemingly surging and prices potentially set to rise?
It's a truly complex issue with multiple layers feeding into it. First, we've had decades of underinvestment in new mines. That's partly due to the cyclical downturns the industry goes through, and partly due to increasing environmental and social scrutiny, which makes permitting much harder.
More hurdles to jump.
Many more hurdles. Second, existing operations are also facing the geological reality of declining ore grades. You simply have to dig up more and more rock to get the same amount of copper out.
Less bang for your buck, essentially.
Exactly. This makes it increasingly difficult and, frankly, astronomically expensive to bring new production online. And then there's the time factor. The lead time for developing a new large-scale copper mine can easily be a decade or more, and that's if everything goes smoothly, which, let's be honest, it rarely does in mining.
A decade.
Think about that time frame. 10 years or more from discovering the deposit to actually producing the first pound of copper. That encompasses exploration, permitting, financing, construction, community engagement. It's a massive undertaking. This structural reality means supply will struggle, fundamentally struggle, to respond quickly to rising demand. This provides strong fundamental support for prices, even during periods of market uncertainty. The world is effectively running low on easy-to-mine, high-grade copper deposits.
That really hammers home the supply challenge.
Okay.
Let's pivot back to SCCO specifically then. How does their market position and competitive edge stand up against this backdrop of surging demand and clearly constrained supply? The report repeatedly highlights them as the low-cost leader.
SCCO is undeniably a top-tier global copper producer, no question. In 2024, their production was approximately 973,000 tons. That placed them squarely among the largest publicly traded and state-owned mining companies in the world, giants. When you look at the global copper producer peer comparison table provided in the analysis for FY 2024 data, you see SCCO right there alongside names like Freeport-McMoRan, BHP, Glencore, Codelco, the biggest players.
So they're in the big leagues.
Absolutely. But where SCCO truly shines and what really differentiates them is in their cost structure. It's truly in a league of its own.
And that's their defining competitive advantage, right? Their first quartile position on the global copper cost curve. Give us the numbers again. Just how low are their costs compared to competitors, and what does that really mean for their business model day to day?
Okay, their 2024 operating cash cost was an exceptionally low $0.89 per pound of copper, and that's net of those crucial byproduct credits.
89 cents a pound.
89 cents. To put that in perspective, Freeport-McMoRan reported a unit net cash cost of $1.56 per pound in 2024. Glencore's was a $1.69 per pound.
So significantly lower, almost half in some cases.
Substantially structurally lower, yes. In fact, for 2025, management has guided for costs to fall even further into a remarkable range of $0.75 and 80 cents per pound.
Even lower. How?
Partly due to efficiencies, maybe higher byproduct credits anticipated. But what's fascinating here is that this superior cost structure functions as a powerful economic moat, a really deep one. In an industry facing structural headwinds like declining ore grades and rising input costs, the marginal cost of production, the cost to produce that next pound of copper globally is on a steady upward trajectory.
It costs more to get the last bit out.
Exactly. Because SCCO's costs are so well below this rising marginal cost, they are positioned to capture disproportionately high profit margins in a rising price environment. This isn't just a slight advantage, it's a profound structural one. It ensures robust profitability and cash flow generation across the entire commodity cycle. They effectively have a much, much wider margin of safety than their peers, allowing them to remain profitable even when others might be struggling or even losing money.
So SCCO isn't just sitting on huge reserves and operating incredibly efficiently. They're also translating that directly into phenomenal financial performance. Let's delve into their financial pulse now. The 10-year financial summary provided in the sources gives us a great look at their performance over time through cycles. What key trends do you see in their revenue, gross profit, EBITDA, and net income? Do they just follow the copper market pretty closely, or is there a layer of resilience there we should be aware of?
They absolutely do follow the copper market closely, yes, but with that crucial layer of resilience you just mentioned. It's quite visible in the data. The numbers from 2015 to 2024 clearly show that their revenues and profits fluctuate, sometimes quite dramatically, in line with the cyclical nature of the copper market. When copper prices rise, their top and bottom lines expand significantly and vice versa. That's expected.
Right. Leverage to the commodity.
Exactly. However, what truly stands out is their powerful operating leverage to copper prices. For instance, look at the jump between 2020 and 2021. A 37% increase in revenue, largely driven by higher copper prices, resulted in a massive 76% surge in EBITDA.
Double the revenue growth.
And an even more impressive 116% increase in net income, almost triple.
Wow.
This vividly demonstrates the company's ability to translate top-line growth into disproportionately higher profits when prices are favorable. That low cost base really kicks in. And despite the inherent cyclicality of the mining industry, you can also see remarkably consistent positive operating cash flow throughout that entire decade, even during the downturns like 2015-16 or 2020.
Still generating cash.
Still generating good cash. This isn't just luck. It's a direct outcome of their low-cost operations providing that buffer.
That operating leverage is really striking. It also sounds like they're a consistent cash flow generation machine, as that report puts it, with a very prudent balance sheet. Could you elaborate on their cash flow prowess? How do they manage to self-fund so much of their growth and those shareholder returns?
They truly are a cash flow powerhouse. In 2024, cash flow from operations reached an impressive $4.4
billion. $4.4
billion. Yes. And this comfortably funded their $1.0 billion in capital expenditures, which includes both sustaining capital for existing operations and initial investments for their growth projects, and still left plenty to cover $1.6 billion in dividends paid out.
So, covering CapEx and dividends easily from operations?
Easily. This ability to self-fund both ambitious growth initiatives and substantial shareholder returns is really a hallmark of a top-tier operator in this space. What's even more impressive, perhaps, is the resilience of this cash generation. Even during the market trough in 2020, amidst all the global uncertainty of that year, the company still generated a very healthy $2.8 billion in operating cash flow.
Still strong even then.
Very strong. This defensive characteristic is a direct result, again, of their low-cost structure. It provides a substantial floor for cash flows, ensuring financial stability even when commodity prices are weak. This unique combination, defensive cash flow in downturns and explosive earnings in upturns, allows them to maintain strategic investment and dividend programs throughout the entire cycle. That's a key advantage over higher-cost rivals who might be forced to cut back sharply on CapEx or dividends when prices fall.
And how about their balance sheet? You mentioned prudent. Are they piling on debt to achieve this impressive performance, or is it genuinely strong? What does their overall financial health look like?
Not at all piling on debt. Their balance sheet is managed with remarkable prudence, earning them an investment-grade credit rating, which, you know, is a testament to their financial discipline. It's not easy for miners to get and keep that.
Right.
At the end of 2024, total long-term debt stood at $5.8 billion against a substantial $9.2 billion in stockholders' equity. This results in a very conservative debt-to-equity ratio of just 0.63x.
Very manageable.
Very manageable. Furthermore, their net debt-to-EBITDA ratio was an incredibly healthy 0.43x. That's calculated as $2.75 billion in net debt, which is total debt minus cash divided by that $6.42 billion in EBITDA. A ratio of 0.43x is exceptionally low, especially for a capital-intensive industry like mining. It means they could effectively pay off their entire net debt with less than 6 months of their operating earnings.
Incredible buffer.
It is. This financial conservatism gives them immense flexibility. They can invest aggressively in growth, or they can weather severe commodity downturns without, you know, breaking a sweat. It's a luxury many highly leveraged peers simply don't have. It's a rock-solid financial foundation.
So, strong cash flow, healthy balance sheet. What about profitability? Are their margins as exceptional as their low costs suggest? Or is there some kind of catch we're missing?
Their profitability metrics are indeed exceptional, and there's no real catch. It's a direct, logical result of their operational advantages. Plain and simple. Their EBITDA margins consistently exceed 50% in favorable price environments. They even reached a peak of 62.7% back in 2021 when copper prices were soaring.
Over 60% EBITDA margin.
Phenomenal for a miner. Their operating margins are also frequently in the 40-55% range. Again, very strong. These high margins are a direct reflection of the company's remarkably low-cost operations. They simply capture a disproportionate share of the revenue dollar as profit compared to their peers.
Makes sense.
And when you look at their returns on capital, they're equally strong. For example, their return on equity, or ROE, was reported at an impressive 41.74% on a trailing 12-month basis as of mid-2025.
Over 40% ROE.
Yes. That's a clear testament to their efficient use of their equity base to generate substantial profits. It showcases their ability to translate that operational excellence into truly top-tier financial returns for shareholders.
That's a phenomenal financial picture. It really sounds like a company that's not just strong today, but planning very aggressively for tomorrow. So what does a company with such deep pockets and these incredible strategic reserves do next? It seems they're not just resting on their laurels. They're actively constructing their future. And that brings us to their ambitious organic growth pipeline. The analysis calls it extensive, well-defined, and fully funded. What's their vision for growth, and how are they actually planning to achieve it?
A central pillar, maybe the central pillar, of the investment case for SCCO is that their future growth is essentially embedded within their existing asset portfolio. They don't necessarily need costly external acquisitions to grow significantly.
They own the growth already.
In large part, yes. They have a stated capital investment program exceeding $15 billion over the coming years.
$15 billion?
Mm-hmm.
That's huge.
It's a truly massive sum, yes, and an ambitious goal to go with it, to increase their annual copper production to 1.5 million tons by 2032. Now, remember, their 2025 production guidance is around 965,800 tons. So 1.5 million tons represents a potential increase of over 50%.
More than 50% growth in under a decade.
That's the plan. And what's fascinating here, and reassuring for investors perhaps, is that these projects are staggered over the next decade. It's not all happening at once. It provides a very visible and phased pathway to significantly higher production volumes. You can almost see the roadmap clearly laid out, offering exceptional long-term production visibility, assuming they execute.
Okay, so this isn't just a distant dream. It's a concrete plan with specific projects identified. Can you highlight a few of these major development projects that are expected to contribute to this massive growth? What are the big ones?
Certainly. Looking at the major growth project pipeline table included in the analysis, some key projects truly stand out as potential game changers for their future production profile. For example, the Tia Maria project in Peru. It's projected to add about 120,000 tons of copper annually, with a projected startup currently slated for 2027.
Tia Maria. That's the one with the history.
Yeah, that's the one. It has been subject to significant historical community opposition and delays, as we discussed. So its successful execution would be a key de-risking event for SCCO and a major signal.
Okay, what else?
Then there's Michiquillé, also in Peru. This one is even larger, estimated to produce a massive 225,000 tons of copper annually, though it has a later projected startup, currently around 2032.
A 250,000 tons from one project.
Potentially, yes. It's a mammoth undertaking. It could add as much copper as some entire mid-tier producers currently output. However, its significant size also means it's likely prone to heightened scrutiny from local communities and environmental groups. SCCO will need to employ really sophisticated community engagement strategies starting very early to avoid the kind of multi-year delays we've seen with other large projects in the region.
A huge prize, but also a huge challenge.
Absolutely. And over in Mexico, the El Arco project is anticipated to yield around 190,000 tons of copper annually, maybe starting around 2030. These are just a few examples, but they really underpin that significant 50% plus production increase target. It demonstrates the sheer scale of their organic growth ambitions.
That's a truly massive pipeline. And the report notes that SCCO's reliance on this organic growth, growing from within their own assets, offers significant advantages. What are those advantages, especially when we see other major miners pursuing these huge, costly mergers and acquisitions in a scramble for new reserves?
That's precisely it. Organic growth allows them to deploy capital directly into their own high-quality ore bodies, which theoretically they know intimately. This should generate higher returns on investment compared to going out and acquiring existing assets at market premiums, especially in a hot market.
Avoiding bidding wars.
Exactly. We've seen the recent wave of mega merger attempts in the mining sector. Think BHP's ultimately unsuccessful bid for Anglo American. It really underscores the challenge and the sheer expense many producers face in securing future growth and replacing reserves in a world where high-quality deposits are getting harder and harder to find. SCCO is largely insulated from this competitive M&A pressure because they already possess the assets needed for their future growth. They don't have to overpay for external assets or deal with the often messy complexities of integrating different corporate cultures and systems. They are, in essence, their own best acquisition target.
Makes sense. They control their own destiny, in theory.
In theory. However, and this is a critical counterpoint we need to keep hammering home, This strategy also creates, or rather concentrates, a highly significant risk profile.
Back to the concentration risk.
The success of their entire long-term growth plan, that 1.5 million ton target, is contingent almost entirely on their ability to successfully navigate the complex and often challenging permitting, regulatory, and social environments of just two countries, Peru and Mexico. This raises an important question, doesn't it? What happens if there's a significant political shift in one of those countries, or a prolonged period of community opposition, as we've seen historically with Tia Maria?
Right. One major hiccup could derail a big chunk of the plan.
Precisely. A significant delay, or even a derailment of a project like Michiquillé, for example, which is slated to add that massive 250,000 tons of copper annually, would have a huge impact on their long-term production targets and their financial projections. This stands in stark contrast to more geographically diversified miners, like BHP or Rio Tinto, who can better absorb a setback in a single jurisdiction because they have operations spread across the globe.
A different risk profile entirely.
Completely different. So while SEO's growth trajectory is impressive on paper, it carries a material and highly concentrated execution risk. It's perhaps the biggest asterisk next to their growth story.
That's a really important counterpoint to the organic growth advantage. Okay, finally in this section, let's talk about their capital allocation framework. The analysis says it prioritizes internal investment funding, that growth pipeline, and substantial returns to shareholders via dividends. And again, it's heavily influenced by Grupo Mexico. What does their capital expenditure look like historically and going forward? And how does that dividend policy play out in practice?
Capital expenditures, or CapEx, have been consistently managed, averaging approximately $1.0 billion annually in recent years. That $1 billion covers both the ongoing maintenance of their existing large-scale operations known as sustaining capital and the initial development costs for their growth projects.
Okay, $1 billion a year, roughly.
Roughly. Looking ahead, the company plans to ramp up this investment significantly. They've budgeted $1.6 billion for 2025, specifically to advance key projects like El Pilar in Mexico and, importantly, Tia Maria in Peru. So they're clearly investing for the future and putting their money where their growth plans are. That part is clear.
And the returns to shareholders.
When it comes to returning capital to shareholders, it's a true cornerstone of SCCO's financial policy, no doubt about it. They have a long, long history of paying a significant portion of their earnings as dividends. Now, the dividend itself is variable. It fluctuates reflecting the company's performance and, of course, the copper price environment. But the payout ratio, the percentage of net income paid out as dividends, is consistently high, often exceeding 60% of net income.
Over 60%, that is high.
It is. And get this. In 2023, the company paid out a huge $3.1 billion in dividends on net income of $2.4 billion.
Wait, they paid out more than they earned?
Yes, a payout ratio well over 100%. This clearly demonstrates a willingness, perhaps even a mandate from the parent, to return more than 100% of annual earnings to shareholders during certain periods, likely drawing on cash reserves or prior earnings. This ensures a consistent, albeit variable, income stream for investors.
Very focused on the dividend then.
Yeah.
And what about share buybacks? Is that part of their strategy at all to return capital, or is it exclusively about those generous dividends?
Well, interestingly, SCCO does have a board-authorized $3.0 billion share repurchase program on the books, and they have used it in the past. About $2.9 billion has been executed under that program to date.
Okay, so they have done buybacks.
They have. However, that program has been inactive since 2016. Completely dormant for years now. The clear preference, the overwhelming preference, for dividends over share buybacks is a critical aspect of their capital allocation strategy. And it's very, very likely driven by the cash flow objectives of their 88.9% owner, Grupo Mexico.
The parent needs the cash flow via dividends.
That seems to be the most logical explanation. For the parent company, a predictable and substantial dividend stream from its highly profitable subsidiary is likely a primary financial goal, supporting their own financial structure, debt servicing, or other ventures. While this policy benefits all shareholders seeking income, it does mean that the company has foregone opportunities, potentially significant ones, to repurchase its shares during periods of market weakness or when the stock might have seemed undervalued.
Missed opportunities, perhaps.
Perhaps. That's a strategy, buying back shares low, that could have been more accretive to long-term value for minority shareholders, specifically, as buying back shares reduces the share count and increases earnings per share over time. This structure makes the dividend highly reliable, yes, but it suggests a degree of inflexibility in opportunistically deploying capital for the maximum benefit of all shareholders equally. The parents' needs seem paramount.
So the strategy seems pretty clear. Massive organic growth, primarily funded by that robust cash flow we talked about, with a very strong preference for dividends, heavily influenced by their parent company. Okay, let's dig deeper now into the engine room, their operational excellence, and crucially, the associated risks. We've touched on their low cost quite a bit, but how do they maintain this unit cost leadership so consistently? What makes them so uniquely efficient year after year?
SECO's cash cost per pound of copper is, as we said, consistently among the lowest in the world. It's a key metric, maybe the key metric, that underpins their entire investment case. In 2024, they reported that operating cash cost of $1.89 per pound of copper, net of byproduct credits. That was actually an improvement from $1.03 per pound in 2023.
So costs came down.
They did. And for 2025, management has guided for costs to remain exceptionally low, potentially even dipping into that range of $0.75 to $1.80 per pound.
Incredible.
It really is. For comparison, remember those 2024 numbers for peers? Freeport at $1.56, Glencore at $1.69. SECO's costs are not just lower, they are in a completely different league. What's fascinating here is that this leadership isn't accidental. It's not just luck. It results from several structural advantages and deliberate management strategies working together. These include, first and foremost, the very high quality and the sheer large scale of its ore bodies. That allows for significant economies of scale you just can't get at smaller mines.
Bigger is cheaper, per unit.
Often, yes. And second, it's their vertically integrated operational model, which we discussed. That gives them tight control over every step of the production process, from mine to metal. They are simply operating from a superior resource base with highly optimized processes.
And a big part of that low-cost structure you mentioned earlier and just now comes from their byproducts. How significant are these byproduct credits in their overall cost equation? Can you give us that concrete, vivid example again, maybe breaking down the numbers?
Yes, they are absolutely critical. They act as a powerful inherent cost deflation mechanism. The revenue from the molybdenum, the silver, the zinc they sell is directly credited against the cost of producing copper. Let me give you the numbers again from 2024 just to illustrate the sheer impact. The cash cost before accounting for any byproduct revenues was actually $2.10 per pound.
Okay, $2.10 gross cost.
Right. But then the byproduct credits the revenue from selling the moly, silver, zinc, etc., amounted to a substantial $1.30 per pound.
$1.30.
Yes. Which is subtracted from that $2.10 gross cost, reducing the net cash cost to the final reported figure of every $1.89 per pound.
Wow, the byproducts cut the cost by more than half.
Effectively, yes. It clearly demonstrates that the market prices of molybdenum, silver, and zinc have a direct and very material impact on SECO's cost competitiveness. When byproduct prices are strong, SECO's cost advantage over pure-play copper producers widens considerably. This provides both a partial hedge in weak copper markets because maybe molybdenum prices are holding up, and it amplifies their profitability during broad commodity bull markets when everything is rising. It's like having a built-in shock absorber and a turbocharger for their cost structure, all in one.
That's a great way to put it. Despite this incredible efficiency, though, I imagine they're still exposed to broader economic factors.
Yeah.
What about input price inflation, especially with things like rising energy costs globally? Can they completely escape that?
No, unfortunately not completely. Despite all their operational efficiencies and those powerful byproduct credits, SECO is not immune to inflation in key input costs, many of which are largely beyond their direct control. Fuel, gas, and electricity are the most significant components, accounting for roughly 26% of the total production costs back in 2024.
Over a quarter of their costs.
Yes. Other major cost drivers include labor, explosives for blasting, and repair materials for their massive equipment fleets. Now, the company does utilize strategies like long-term power purchase agreements and other hedging mechanisms to try and mitigate some of this volatility, but significant and sustained increases in global energy and labor costs can certainly exert pressure on their margins, even theirs. It's a constant battle for all miners, even the most efficient ones like SECO, to manage these external cost pressures while trying to maintain their competitive edge.
Okay, now let's get into the really sharp end, the in-depth risk assessment. The report emphasizes that SECO's investment profile has significant concentrated risks. We briefly touched on these earlier, but let's really unpack them now, starting with commodity price risk.
Mm-hmm.
How vulnerable are they to price fluctuations, given their sort of pure play nature in copper and related metals?
This is, without a doubt, the most significant and pervasive risk facing the company. It overhangs everything. As an unhedged producer of copper, molybdenum, zinc, and silver, meaning they don't generally lock in future selling prices through financial contracts or hedging instruments, SECO's revenues, profit margins, and cash flows are directly and materially exposed to the inherent volatility of global commodity prices.
They take the price the market gives them.
Pretty much, yes. A sustained downturn in the price of copper, which is their primary product by far, would have a severe adverse effect on their financial performance. It could significantly impact their ability to fund both their ambitious capital programs and, potentially, even those generous dividends if it lasted long enough or went up enough. They ride the copper price wave, for better or for worse. This makes them highly sensitive to global economic cycles and supply-demand imbalances. If copper takes a significant dive, so does SECO's profitability, despite their low costs. The low costs just mean they stay profitable longer than others.
Got it. And then there's that big one we keep circling back to, geopolitical and regulatory risks.
Yeah.
You mentioned their operational concentration in Peru and Mexico is their single greatest vulnerability. Can you give us more specific examples of why this is such a critical risk? Really bring to life what those risks look like on the ground for them.
Absolutely. This is where the theoretical risks become very, very real. Let's take Peru first. The country has, unfortunately, a well-documented history of political instability and social unrest that has directly impacted the mining sector numerous times. We've seen concrete examples affecting SECO directly. Community opposition, as we've mentioned, significantly delayed the development of their key Tia Maria project for years and years, turning it into almost a textbook example of the challenges around gaining and maintaining a social license to operate.
Right, the Tia Maria saga.
Exactly. And beyond just delays, remember back in 2022, protests near their existing Cuajone mine actually led to a temporary shutdown of operations. Protesters blocked critical infrastructure, including roads, and even cut off the water supply for several weeks.
Shut down a producing mine.
Yes. Forced a complete halt to production. It cost the company millions in lost revenue and really highlighted how vulnerable their concentrated footprint can be to local actions. This wasn't just a nuisance, it was a stark reminder. So the risk of future political turmoil, sudden shifts towards more interventionist government policies regarding taxation or regulation, or renewed social unrest remains a persistent and material threat to both their ongoing operations and their crucial growth plans in Peru.
Okay, and what about Mexico? Different set of issues there.
Somewhat different, yes. In Mexico, the regulatory landscape has also become arguably more challenging in recent years, often with little advance warning. For example, in 2023, the government enacted significant changes to the mining law. These changes reduced the term length for new concessions, they imposed new conditions on water usage rights, and introduced new community contribution requirements.
More red tape, essentially.
More red tape, potentially higher costs, and greater uncertainty. Now, while the company stated publicly they believe these specific 2023 changes will not materially impact their current operations, the risk of future adverse changes like tax increases, higher royalties, or even more stringent environmental regulations is certainly elevated and remains an ongoing concern for anyone operating there. Furthermore, security issues related to organized crime, particularly concerning the transport of materials and the protection of personnel and equipment, pose an ongoing operational risk in certain regions of Mexico. This needs constant vigilance and can add unexpected costs and complexities to their operations. It's a delicate balance, operating efficiently while constantly mitigating these external, often unpredictable factors in both countries.
Beyond the politics and regulations, what about environmental and community relations challenges? Mining is often seen, rightly or wrongly, as environmentally impactful. And community relations can clearly be a minefield, as you just highlighted again with Tia Maria and Cuajone.
You're absolutely right. And these two things, environment and community, are deeply intertwined with maintaining their social license to operate, which is fundamental. As a large-scale mining company, SECO inevitably faces substantial environmental risks. Their operations are subject to stringent and constantly evolving environmental laws and regulations in both Peru and Mexico. The risk of environmental incidents, things like tailings, dam failures, which can be catastrophic, or water and soil contamination from operations is ever present, despite best practices. An incident like that could result in significant financial liabilities, severe reputational damage, and potentially prolonged operational shutdowns. The costs associated with environmental compliance, ongoing remediation, and eventual mine reclamation are substantial and a permanent part of their cost structure.
And the community side?
Equally critical, maybe even more so day to day, is gaining and maintaining the support of the local communities where they operate. As we saw with Tia Maria and the Quahona shutdown, demands from communities, whether for financial contributions, infrastructure development, employment opportunities, land rights, or environmental protection, can lead to conflicts, protests, and blockades.
Disruptions.
Exactly. These often result in costly delays and disruptions to operations, or, crucially, to the development of new projects like the ones in their pipeline. Building genuine trust and demonstrating shared value with these communities isn't just a nice-to-have corporate social responsibility thing. It's a fundamental operational imperative for long-term stability and growth. It's a dynamic, often tense relationship that requires continuous on-the-ground engagement and significant investment.
And finally, what about the more standard operational and execution risks that any large mining company faces, especially one with such incredibly ambitious growth plans involving massive construction projects?
Yes, those standard mining risks are certainly present too, and they just add another layer of complexity to manage. These include things like geotechnical instability within the huge open pits, the risk of wall failures, unexpected geological conditions turning out different than the models predicted, equipment failures on massive trucks or mills, and of course, safety incidents involving their large workforce at these complex industrial sites.
The basics of running a mine.
The basics, but on a massive scale. Additionally, and this is really crucial given their growth plans, there is significant execution risk associated with that massive $15 billion plus capital project pipeline. Building multiple mines of this scale, often in challenging geographies with complex logistics and community dynamics, is an incredibly complex undertaking. Any significant cost overruns, construction delays, or failures to achieve the projected production rates or recovery rates on these large-scale developments could negatively impact the company's future growth trajectory, their financial returns, and ultimately, investor confidence. It's not just about having the plans on paper. It's about flawlessly executing them in very challenging environments, often years into the future. A lot can go wrong.
Okay, so we've dissected SECO's strengths, the reserves, the costs. We've looked at its operations, its financials, and, crucially, its concentrated risks. Now let's try to put it all into the macro lens. Consider the broader trends shaping the world and the industry, and importantly, let's talk about its valuation. How do these macroeconomic and thematic considerations really intertwine with SECO's prospects? What are the big picture forces at play that will truly shape their destiny, perhaps even more than their own actions?
Yeah, SECO's long-term prospects are absolutely deeply intertwined with several major macroeconomic and thematic trends that are truly reshaping the global economy and commodity markets as we speak. The most powerful thematic tailwind, the one we keep coming back to because it's so central, is that undeniable global push towards decarbonization and electrification.
The energy transition.
Exactly. The electrification of everything, from our cars and trucks to our power generation systems, is fundamentally a story about copper. Copper is the enabling metal. This structural trend provides a multi-decade demand driver that is likely less correlated with traditional industrial business cycles than historical demand sources like construction or general manufacturing were.
So, a more stable source of demand growth.
Potentially more stable and definitely structurally growing. As the world builds out huge fleets of EVs, massive charging networks, vast solar farms, countless wind turbines, and modernizes its power grids to handle it all, the demand for copper is set to grow substantially, year after year after year. This creates a fundamentally favorable long-term pricing environment for low-cost producers like SECO, who have the reserves to meet that demand. This isn't just a fleeting trend, it's a multi-decade structural shift, a tsunami of demand that will keep companies like SECO incredibly busy for a very long time.
We talked about China earlier, though, and its massive influence on short-term copper prices. How much does Chinese demand and just the general global economic cycle still weigh on the company, even with that strong, long-term tailwind of electrification humming in the background?
That's the constant tension, isn't it? While the energy transition clearly defines the long-term outlook, short to medium term copper prices remain heavily influenced by the health of the overall global economy, and particularly by demand patterns in China.
Still over half the market.
Still over half the market. So shifts in China's industrial production, its infrastructure spending levels, the state of its property sector, these all have an outsized impact on the global supply-demand balance for copper and, importantly, on market sentiment. A significant slowdown in China, for example, can quickly create an overhang of perceived or real supply and push prices lower, even if the long-term structural demand from EVs and renewables remains perfectly robust.
short-term noise versus long-term signal.
Exactly. So for you, the listener trying to understand SCCO, you really must monitor Chinese economic data closely. It remains a key indicator of near-term price direction for copper, and therefore a key driver for SCCO's immediate financial performance and stock price volatility. It's this constant tension between that powerful long-term tailwind and the shorter-term cyclical whims of the global economy, heavily influenced by China.
And on the supply side, we've discussed the constraints, the lack of new mines, the declining grades. Does this create a kind of scarcity premium for companies like SCCO? Does it almost make their existing reserves inherently more valuable just by virtue of their existence and the difficulty of finding more?
I think it absolutely does, yes. The global pipeline of new, large-scale, high-quality copper projects is remarkably thin. Shockingly thin, some might say. Years of underinvestment following the last commodity downturn, combined with those increasing geological, regulatory, and social hurdles we've talked about, have made it exceptionally difficult to bring new supply to market quickly or affordably.
It's just hard to build new mines.
It's incredibly hard. This dynamic, structurally growing demand meeting fundamentally constrained supply is the core basis for a bullish long-term outlook on copper prices. And as the structural deficit becomes more pronounced over the coming years, premier long-life assets like those owned by SCCO are indeed likely to command increasing scarcity premium in the market. They become more valuable simply because there aren't enough new, high-quality copper sources coming online elsewhere to meet the world's needs. Their existing assets are a rare and increasingly precious commodity in a copper-hungry world.
This raises an important question then. How does the broader macroeconomic environment, particularly things like persistent inflation and rising interest rates, impact SCCO? Are these mainly headwinds, or could there actually be some potential tailwinds hidden in there for a company like this?
It's a bit of both, really, and the balance can shift depending on the specifics. Sustained inflation can certainly act as a headwind, no doubt about it. It increases both their operating costs, things like labor, energy, tires, steel balls for grinding mills, explosives, all that stuff, and the massive capital costs required to build out their new projects. That $15 billion pipeline gets more expensive if inflation stays high.
Pushes costs up.
Right. And this puts upward pressure on the long-term incentive price needed for copper. Essentially, copper prices need to stay higher for longer just to make building new mines anywhere in the world economically viable. Conversely, higher interest rates, often implemented by central banks to combat that inflation, can slow overall economic growth. That could potentially dampen near-term industrial demand for copper outside the energy transition, and it also increases the company's cost of capital if they need to borrow money for those big projects.
Makes borrowing more expensive.
Exactly. However, there's a potential tailwind, too. The sheer strength and persistence of the structural demand coming from the energy transition may ultimately provide a higher floor for copper prices than we've seen in past cycles. Even if the global economy slows, the EV and renewable build-out might keep copper demand relatively robust. This could potentially justify higher sustained valuation multiples for top-tier, low-cost producers like SCCO over the long run. So the interplay between inflation, interest rates, economic growth, and that structural energy transition demand will continue to influence copper prices and SCCO's profitability. It's a constantly shifting landscape.
Okay, that brings us logically to the final piece of the puzzle, valuation analysis. The report states pretty clearly that SCCO consistently trades at a premium to its peers. Why? Why does SCCO command such a premium valuation, and perhaps more importantly, is this premium justified, given the company's very real, concentrated geopolitical risk we spend so much time discussing? It's a critical question for any potential investor looking at this stock.
It's a truly critical question, yes. And it's where the rubber really meets the road in terms of an investment decision. Looking at the numbers, as of mid-2025, SCO trades at a price-to-earnings, or PE, ratio of approximately 21.6 times its trailing 12-month earnings. Now, that's actually below its own 10-year historical average PE, but PE ratios for miners can be highly volatile depending on commodity prices.
Right.
A potentially better metric, often preferred for capital-intensive industries like mining because it strips out the effects of debt levels and depreciation policies, is the enterprise value to EBITDA, or EBITDA multiple. For SCCO, that's approximately 13.0x, which is slightly above its 10-year median.
Okay, slightly elevated there.
Slightly. But the most striking multiple, the one that really highlights the premium, is its price-to-book, or PBE ratio. That stands at a very high 8.1x.
8 times book value. That sounds really high for a miner. And when we compare that PB ratio to its peers, it really stands out, doesn't it? SCCO's 8.1x BB is significantly higher than Freeport-McMoRan's 2.1x, its own parent Grupo México's 1.9x, and even a diversified giant like BHP's 2.6x. Why such a persistent, massive premium? What are investors paying extra for here?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? This persistent valuation premium is not an anomaly. It's not a recent phenomenon. It's been a consistent feature of SCO's market perception for years. Investors are consistently willing to pay a higher multiple for SCO's shares due to a collection of superior qualitative attributes that are perhaps not fully captured in simple trailing financial metrics. These include, number one, its unmatched copper reserve base, that longevity, that guarantee of decades of production. Number two, its first quartile cost position, that assurance of profitability through the cycle. And number three, its clear, self-funded organic growth plan, which insulates it from costly and risky M&A.
Quality, visibility, longevity.
Exactly. What's fascinating here is how the market assigns a tangible premium for quality, visibility, and longevity in a commodity sector where those attributes are actually quite rare and therefore highly sought after by long-term investors. The investment debate, therefore, often centers on whether this significant premium adequately compensates investors for the heightened geopolitical and execution risks associated with its concentrated operational footprint in just Peru and Mexico.
The quality versus the risk.
It's a constant weighing of undeniable quality against inherent external vulnerabilities. That's the core tension in valuing SCCO. And of course, for many investors, particularly those seeking income, the dividend yield also acts as a primary valuation anchor or support level. With a current annual dividend hovering around $2.80 per share, the stock offers a yield of about 2.8%. That provides a tangible cash return to shareholders and a degree of valuation support independent of just growth expectations.
A solid yield helps.
It helps. And finally, it's worth noting that for long-life assets like SCCO's mines, valuation methods based on the present value of future cash flows, things like discounted cash flow, DCF, or net asset value, NAV analysis, are particularly relevant. Analysts spend a lot of time building these models. However, these models are highly sensitive, extremely sensitive sometimes, to the long-term copper price assumption used, reminding us that even the most sophisticated valuation models ultimately rely on educated guesses about the future price of the commodity. Hashtag outro.
So what does this all mean at the end of the day? We've really gone deep, I think, into Southern Copper Corporation today. We've uncovered a company that truly stands out with its massive, virtually unparalleled copper reserves, those incredibly low production costs that are the envy of the industry, and a clear, ambitious path for growth fueled by the global energy transition. It's a true heavyweight, isn't it? A critical pillar in a vital industry that is undergoing a historic transformation.
Absolutely. But as we've discussed extensively, this powerhouse also comes with significant concentrated risks attached. Its operational footprint, almost entirely within Peru and Mexico, means it's constantly navigating this delicate balance of geopolitical instability, changing regulations, and complex community relations. That's not going away. And the inherent volatility of commodity prices means their fortunes, while amplified on the upside by their low costs, are still fundamentally tied to the market's unpredictable whims. It's a fascinating, constant balance of undeniable strengths and significant external pressures. And, you know, their ability to actually deliver on those ambitious growth targets will heavily depend on successfully navigating those complex social and political landscapes just as much as their engineering prowess.
That's a great summary. So for you, the learner listening in, the takeaway isn't just about SCCO as one company, but maybe about the very bedrock of our electrified future. Copper is simply indispensable. There's no green transition without it. So consider this as you go about your day. How might the delicate balance between the world's urgent, almost insatiable need for more copper and the complex geopolitical realities of where most of it is actually mined? How might that balance shape not just investment opportunities, but the very pace, the cost, and maybe even the feasibility of the global energy transition itself? Will our green future potentially be delayed or made more expensive simply by a lack of this crucial reddish-brown metal or difficulties in getting it out of the ground?
That's a profound question. And building on that, how might a company like SCCO, sitting on these deep assets and benefiting from formidable low costs, adapt to these ever-changing global dynamics and pressures? This raises another important question for the future. Will their long-term strategy of purely organic growth truly insulate them from these concentrated risks in the long run? Or will the very nature of their operational concentration eventually become their ultimate test, perhaps forcing them, or their controlling shareholder, to consider strategies like diversification or different capital allocation priorities that they have historically resisted?
Really interesting questions to ponder, something to mull over as you go about your day. Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep digging for those insights.